wish I was a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, then I'd root those mountains down. Wish I was a mole in the ground.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Joe Clement. Denise Morris has been our co-producer. The Old Mole comes to you every Monday with interviews, reviews, music, and commentary from a radically democratic socialist feminist perspective to lift your spirits, raise your consciousness, and agitate for the liberation of all people in the earth from capitalism, racism, imperialism, and patriarchy. Today's show starts out with Bill Resnick talking with Jenny Brown, author of the 2019 Verso book Without Apology, Abortion Struggles Today. They discuss why the reproductive rights movements of the 1960s and 70s demobilized, enabling right-to-life forces to gain the initiative and pursue their legislative and judicial strategies now on the verge of success. They also discuss how the reproductive rights and justice projects are organizing to win both the right to terminate an unwanted pregnancy, but also the social and economic supports, like living wages, reduced work hours, universal health and child care, necessary to choose to have and raise children. And then, Old Mole Chelsea Ratzliff talks with Japanese-American poet, composer, teacher, and author Rika Aoki about her forthcoming book Light from Uncommon Stars, out this month with Tor Books. And to wrap up today's show, we listen to the second half of my conversation with Marianne Garneau from last week about the political stakes of workplace organizing. We pay closer attention in this half to the nuts and bolts of organizing for power on the job as an important perspective on what power even is, and how workers are led astray by bosses, capitalist social conditioning, and even unions sometimes. You can listen to and share past episodes of The Old Mole. Find them on KBOO's website at kboo.fm/oldmole. You can email us with questions, comments, or if you'd like to be on the show or suggest something, that's oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter by just searching for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Before I hand it off to Bill Resnick and Jenny Brown, I'd like to let Old Mole Patricia Kohlberg on with a special message.
KBOO's fall membership drive will kick off September 15th, and our theme is The Sounds of Democracy. KBOO is non-commercial, independent, and community-supported radio, one of the most democratic forms of media. During the drive, we'll feature content focused on democracy throughout the radio day. On September 15th, the Old Mole Variety Hour will look at democracy through the lens of cultural work, how the arts like music, photography, theater, and fiction raise up the voices of those too often silenced by the corporate media. As a premium for KBOO donors, the Moles are offering prints of Betty Lee's photography, which document two decades of activists in the streets of Portland. For details, visit the Old Mole webpage on kboo.fm. And thanks for your support. Music by Hanto Beatmaker.
Thanks, Patricia. I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Now we turn to Bill Resnick and Jenny Brown to talk about the politics of reproductive justice, past and present. Bill?
Hi, Jenny Brown. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Jenny Brown is a women's liberation organizer and writer, once an editor of Labor Notes for 10 years. She co-chaired the Alachua County Labor Party, organizing for national health insurance, the right to a job and a living wage, and, of course, Working Persons Political Party under the Labor Party slogan, "The corporations have two parties, we need one of our own." Over the last several years, she's been writing, teaching, and organizing with National Women's Liberation Organization. She was a leader in the grassroots campaign to make morning after pill contraception available over the counter in the United States and was a plaintiff in the winning lawsuit. She's the author of Birth Strike, The Hidden Fight Over Women's Work, and Without Apology, The Abortion Struggle Now. So, Jenny Brown, you've been writing long before the recent Texas provocation. You've been writing that abortion is on the ropes, that the U.S. Supreme Court is clearly bent on reversing Roe v. Wade, or perhaps more boldly even, and what I'm afraid of, creating a legal standard of when life begins in the early fetus and holding the states to that standard. So, Jenny Brown, give us a story, a thumbnail sketch of how the forces that won legal abortion in this country, how they were demobilized, how did it happen, and then we can discuss how we can today again build popular power not only to abolish abortion restrictions, but also win a great deal more of the reproductive freedom and women's liberation program?
Well, the movement to change the abortion law, abortion was legal for the first 100 years of the U.S.'s existence, and then it was made illegal in 1873, and that followed 100 years of repression. And in the late 60s, there were a lot of groups of well-meaning lawyers and doctors and just ordinary women who wanted to change the abortion laws, and many of the things that they suggested were, you know, well, let's make it okay if you already have four children or if you are the victim of rape, that kind of exception to what were all over the country laws against abortion, making it illegal. And this movement bumped along for many years with a few victories, but the victories were almost as bad as defeat because it meant that, you know, you had to go before a hospital board, prove you were suicidal, whatever, made people jump through a lot of hoops, and abortion actually was not any more available than it had been before. Well, by 67 and 68, the young women who were involved in the women's liberation movement, who started the women's liberation movement, including the group Red Stockings, decided that this strategy was actually backwards, that rather than demanding exception to the law, we should get the law repealed entirely. So they set out to do that and were fairly successful. And there were even lawsuits where the courts were starting to dismantle the law. And in New York State, the New York State legislature passed a law in 1970 that basically made abortions legal up through the second trimester as long as they were performed by a doctor. That was the most liberal law in the country. And the way they won that was basically by testifying about their own abortions, talking about the illegal abortions that they had had, and really joining forces with the other big movements of the time to make a demand to make this change. By 1973, the Supreme Court was very worried that some states would have no abortion law at all, which was, of course, the movement's goal. So quickly retrenched and managed to make this decision, Roe, which now has become sort of the limit of the possible, right? But then it was kind of a compromise, and it still had various things the feminist movement didn't want. And the most important thing, of course, is it gave a right, but it didn't provide actual access because you still had to pay for it. And the requirement that doctors do it in many states drove the price up. So it never really made abortion available to everybody who needed one. So how was the movement demobilized? I think to some extent there was a backlash against all of the movements. Some experienced a great deal of repression. Others were sort of undermined by parallel organizing. But in general, throughout the 70s, the movements were largely demobilized. And in the abortion arena, it was in favor of a sort of a more respectable, non-profit-y kind of approach where we would just talk about the extreme cases, rape, incest, life of the mother, sort of going back to the original failed strategy. And this is the strategy of people who are helping other people, not people who are fighting to overthrow their own oppression. So that part of the movement was sort of sidelined in favor of this nonprofit strategy. And that's basically where it has stood. We have been fighting a losing battle, you know, getting pushed backwards every year since the early 80s. We've been experiencing more and more restrictions on abortion rights, and the court has been slowly allowing more restrictions on abortion rights, including, obviously, we have things like the waiting periods requiring ultrasounds, which drives up the price. The waiting period also drives up the price because you have to do two visits and figure out how to accomplish that. If you live a long way away, you have to make two trips. Parental notification and parental consent laws, which are pretty endemic now. And generally, a lot of attacks on the clinics themselves, which arose basically because after abortion was legalized, hospitals were worried about their reputations and refused, in most cases, to provide abortion. So the movement had to start its own clinics to make abortion available at all. And that's why we have the clinics we have now. So this has sort of been the situation. And we've been fighting legal and legislative battles, but the battles in the streets have not been able to get the traction that we had in the late 60s and early 70s. And I think it's partly because our strategy has not been to appeal to everyday women, but more to appeal to the power structure.
Right. This is Cable, listener-supported radio. Every day, Cable reminds you another better world is possible, and indeed, nowadays, necessary. Bill Resnick here for your Old Mole Variety Hour. The variety, of course, is in the struggles from below that we cover and appreciate. I'm talking to Jenny Brown, who works with the Women's Liberation Organization, organizing and writing. Her last book is Without Apology, The Abortion Struggle Now. We've been discussing how we got to this point where abortion rights will likely disappear soon. So, Jenny Brown, the Supreme Court is poised to reverse Roe v. Wade, or worse. And it seems to me now there's little we can do to stop it. Still, women across the country are organizing for a great march, October 2nd, 2.5 weeks from now. My sense is it's going to be the beginning of something big, a real organizing campaign. For folks listening to Cable, you'll hear all about the details on this radio station. Jenny, I'm sure you're going to be speaking somewhere at one of the October 2nd marches, discussing what must be done, how basically to win, what sort of movement will be necessary. You've already alluded to it. We'll go into more detail. Will be necessary to win abortion rights and indeed the reproductive autonomy and justice, and in fact, not just the rights to terminate an unwanted pregnancy, the rights to have children, which is being eroded by the economic and social circumstances of a good percentage of the and precariousness of a good percentage of the population. What do you see happening to the women's liberation struggle?
Well, first of all, there is a bill in Congress which has been introduced since 2013 called the Women's Health Protection Act, which would basically stop states from restricting abortion before viability. So it's not everything that the women's liberation movement originally demanded, but it basically codifies the Roe decision. You know, the Democrats could have presumably passed this one of the many times they've had a majority over the last, 48 years, right? But now we really have a chance to demand it. Of course, it's very likely that the Republicans would filibuster. And this is the problem. I think a lot of feminists are squeamish about the Democratic Senate getting rid of the filibuster. They think, well, the Senate is, you know, is an undemocratic body, right? But at least the filibuster, which basically means you need 60 votes to pass anything, the filibuster keeps worse things from happening. Well, that would be all very well. But what in fact has been happening is the Supreme Court has been making rulings, getting rid of the Voting Rights Act, limiting, you know, basically destroying unions in the public sector, allowing unlimited corporate cash in elections, and now allowing Texas to ban abortion. And there's legislation sitting there that could respond to any of those things and the many other things that we could all think of, but it can't be passed because 40 senators say no. So the filibuster is actually making an undemocratic body, the Senate, even more undemocratic, while giving the courts even more power than they should have. And the courts are laying waste to the few rights that we won over the years through all our hard struggle, right? So this has to end somewhere. And I think that it's important to point out that there's nothing to stop the Republicans, if they get a majority next time, from getting rid of the filibuster either. I mean, they did it for the Supreme Court confirmations, which is why we're actually talking right now about abortion becoming illegal in Texas. And there's a whole pile of things working people need that are currently being held up by the filibuster, or at least that's what the Democrats have been telling us, right? The PRO Act, which would basically put some laws on the side of workers trying to organize a union, $15 minimum wage. So there are a lot of things that we can unite with the rest of the movement around in pushing for a whole panel of things. And I think now we can say abortion should be also among those. The current situation with the Women's Health Protection Act is that there are 48 Democratic co-sponsors in the Senate. Joe Manchin in West Virginia and Bob Casey in Pennsylvania are the only two holdouts. And no Republicans have signed on, although Susan Collins in Maine and Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, you know, nominally support abortion rights. So I think pushing Congress on that is a top priority. And then we have to think about the other things that we need, right? As you were saying, you know, the right to have an abortion means nothing if you don't have the money to get one. So that's why we need expanded and improved Medicare for All bill, which is in both houses. And also, obviously, if we could get it, even if we could get enough Democrats to support it, the Republicans would filibuster it. And that would cover all reproductive options. So the combination of those two laws would give us a lot better situation than we have now. But we're told we can't get anything. And the sort of the sight of what we could imagine happening, I mean, even the possibility of a Green New Deal, everybody says, well, you can't do that because of the filibuster. So I think we have to call the Democrats on their bluff and see if they really are going to defend reproductive rights and all of these other things that we need. And it's an opportunity for us to unite with other portions of the movement that are pushing for this.
This is cable listener-supported radio. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety. I'm talking to Jenny Brown. Her latest book is Without Apology, The Abortion Struggle Now. We've been discussing how we got to this point and what kind of movement will be necessary to gain abortion rights and indeed the social services and incomes that make it possible for women to have full lives and raise children. Jenny, one last issue. There's several European societies that have abortion on demand and universal single-payer medical care and child care and much longer paid vacations. And yet they're ruled by white male elites who make the key decisions in the society. It's sort of a semi-welfare capitalism being eroded slowly over the years, but still so superior to the precariousness and pain and overwork that probably majority of American families are subjected to. So the question for me is partly, how do we go beyond just these social democratic material gains, as important as they are? How do we build the foundations of a different kind of society, the kind of society actually that's going to become necessary if we're ever going to deal with climate change? The old America cannot last very long. We cannot keep consuming and creating pollution at the rate we are throughout the world. And that's going to require really building a different way of producing what we produce and what, in fact, are the ways that our cities and our families operate. Jenny, I don't know if you've thought about these questions, but how do we go beyond just trying to make material gains in this society and activate a sufficient number of people so that it's the left that, in fact, directs and implements something like the Green New Deal rather than the right and the corporations who have their own idea of how to deal with climate change. They're making it very clear that they believe a lot of new technologies can save our system so they can stay and maintain their same privilege and operations in our post-climate change world. How do you see that kind of movement? There's a movement now, it seems to me, we're fighting for our lives now. And the women's movement and the reproductive rights and movement is fundamental to the answer to climate change. How do you see that kind of movement, a real crusade happening?
First of all, in Europe, where abortion rights was first introduced after the revolution in Russia in 1919, they made abortion legal for the first time anywhere. So there's a long socialist tradition of standing up to the religious powers that say we shouldn't have abortion and the capitalist powers that say we shouldn't have abortion. And in European countries that continue to have some social democratic programs, the reason that they have them is that the labor movements were strong enough in the post-war period to put in national healthcare systems, which then, when the feminist movement demanded abortion, those were included in the national healthcare system. So that resulted in a much better situation for women and all parents in those countries. So I think that basically we need to struggle on the basic things that everyone needs. You know, we need to unite the many to defeat the few, and I think this is a great opportunity to do it. Obviously, some of the questions that you're asking are much larger and longer discussion. But the basic principles are that everything that we have, we fought for. You know, the Supreme Court did not give us abortion rights. We fought for them. And similarly, we're going to have to fight for everything we get. And the way to do that is to unite as many people as possible who have, you know, the vast majority, the 99%, whatever you want to call it, have an interest in changing the system fundamentally. And we can see it every day as things get worse and worse. So some of these crises are going to result in new alliances and new formations that I think will get us out of the crisis and make a better future.
Jenny Brown, thanks so much for talking to us today. Where can we find, I know we can find a number of your articles on Jacobin. What do you suggest?
Yeah, I have a blog called Birthstrike It's birthstrike.blog, and that has a collection of articles about these issues, and then Jacobin, and then my work in Labor Notes is on the Labor Notes website, so that's a good selection of stuff. The Birth Strike book is published by PM Press, and you can get it from them.
Thanks a lot for talking to us today, Jenny Brown.
Thanks a lot, Bill. Really enjoyed it.
Listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was a little blues banjo played by me, your host, Joe Clement. And before that, Bill Resnick was talking with Jenny Brown about the history and state of abortion politics and reproductive justice. Later in the show, Marianne Garneau and I will finish our conversation we started last week around the political stakes of workplace organizing. But up next, Old Mole Chelsea Ratzliff talks with Japanese-American poet, composer, teacher, and critically acclaimed author Rika Aoki about her forthcoming book, Light from Uncommon Stars, out this month with Tor Books.
Rika Aoki is a poet, composer, teacher, and author of Seasonal Velocities, Himalaya Hilo, a Hilo Song, Why Dust Shall Never Settle Upon This Soul, The Great Space Adventure, and now Light from Uncommon Stars, out September 28th from Tor Books. Rika is a two-time Lambda Award finalist and winner of the Eli Coppola Chapbook Contest, the Corson Bishop Poetry Prize, and a University Award from the Academy of American Poets. She was also the inaugural performer for the first ever transgender stage at San Francisco Pride and has performed around the world. Incredibly multi-talented, she is also a former national judo champion and the founder of the International Transgender Martial Arts Alliance. We were honored to host her as one of our visiting writers at Washington State University last year. Thank you so much for joining me today, Rika, and welcome to The Mole.
Oh my gosh, thank you very much for having me, and thank you everybody for listening.
Light from Uncommon Stars is your fifth book in your second novel. Can you give listeners an overview of the book and talk about what this novel means for you at this point in your career?
My previous books had brought so many good things to me, and I wanted to give something very special back. This book, Light from Uncommon Stars, is my first book with one of the Big Five presidents, part of Macmillan. And as a professor, I order my textbooks from Macmillan, and suddenly there's going to be Macmillan on one of my books. And that means a lot to me in two different ways. The first way is very much personal affirmation. I love the small presses, and I love the agility and the genius and the brilliance and just the fertile community and the support that I've got with these presses. But with this book, with Light from Uncommon Stars, suddenly I don't have to worry about rent. I don't have to worry for a while about health insurance or the day-to-day. I've been working as an adjunct professor for years and years and years, and I chose to stay as an adjunct so I can write. For those of you who don't know, the way we're paid, we're sort of like, in some ways, grad students. We go from term to term, and we just hope we're accepted for, you know, the next year. And it was fun to teach, but there's not that much security. And I went on this course intentionally so I could continue writing. And it was a big risk. It was a big jump, saying to myself, let's take this path and see what happens. And so for me to finally have this on a personal level, oh my God, it feels so nice. It feels like as if, all right, girl, you made it to here. Now what can we do with it? And that leads me to the second thing that I really love about this. Suddenly, I have the platform to meet and to interact with more readers, more than I've ever had before. I asked myself very intentionally, what do I want to do with this next book? And I wanted to write about my neighborhood at the present. I wanted to write about the people I grew up with. I wanted to write about the San Gabriel Valley. I wanted to write about people who are people of color, who are queer, but not queer in the West Hollywood way, but queer in the El Monte way. I wanted to talk about donuts and that one donut shop that I got to drown my tears in when I got rejected from a poetry journal many years ago. Himalaya Hilo was my first novel, and Himalaya Hilo was largely about thank you to my ancestors. It was my past. It was my grandmother. It was my uncle. It was all the stories I grew up with. With Light from Uncommon Stars, I finally felt ready to write about my present, about people who aren't my ancestors, people who in some ways I feel need my ancestors. Relationship is far more one of me being able to give, as opposed to when I'm talking about my ancestors. I can just tell you everything that I've received. But now with this fifth book and my second novel, I want to give to the community because I love my community so much.
Light from Uncommon Stars is a galaxy of a novel. Your characters contain worlds in and of themselves. You have a Stargate captain who is at once a mother, an alien, a queer lover, and the owner of a donut shop. You have a computer program who is also a daughter, a violin teacher known as the Queen of Hell, and a trans runaway who brings all of these characters together. They're wrapped in a song that I can only name as donuts and ducks, violins and video games. As a trans writer, why worlds? Why space?
Well, because I'm also a human. And why not worlds? And why not space? I think that as a trans writer, or anybody who writes as POC or trans or is writing from any sort of margin, from any sort of place of, shall we say, less than plenty, less than abundance, somewhere off the mainstream, one of the most insidious oppressions is losing our agency sometimes to dream. And sometimes we cede that agency very, very willingly and very, very necessarily. We're fighting for, you know, as a trans person, fighting for the right to live and to use the bathroom and to not be harassed. And all of these are immediate risks to who we are, our validity as people. And as a writer, do you not think I'm going to, you know, I'm going to use the skills that I've been given, whatever those skills are. For me, it's writing, to fight for my family, to fight for my community, the people I love, with everything I have. And as a writer, part of everything I have is writing. However, at the end of the day, the end of a life, that can be kind of sad because while you were fighting for your life, other writers were writing about the stars. Mm-hmm. And with this book, I wanted to see if I could do both. Maybe in some ways I need to apologize for writing this book because I couldn't put my dreams away. I couldn't put the stars away. This book in some ways was very selfish. Rather than directly addressing transphobia and other things, I also wanted to be creative about it. I wanted to put it into a story. And I think I can say that about my entire writing career. But with this book, I wanted to try to pull that, glorified the genius and the brilliance and the resilience of so many of the glorious, brilliant, and resilient people I know, but also to give them the stars, also to give them brilliant music, also to give them salvation and some hope and a lot of donuts.
Your protagonist is a trans biracial girl who experiences verbal, sexual, and physical abuse throughout the novel. Yet it seems to be because of her lived, embodied experience that she can become the violinist who changes everything. Can you talk about what it is that liberates her to play her music, to hear her own voice, as you put it, and its impact on her found family?
Well, she does. right? I mean, Katrina, who is this woman, who is this girl, this young woman, this girl on the cusp of womanhood, she's transgender. She does. She gives herself she liberates herself. And I think that's what makes her a hero. It's her. And I've seen this with so many beautiful, amazing, and I'm going to say beautiful and amazing and glorious a lot because this interview is live and I don't have time to think about synonyms. But in any case, I've seen this over and over where people have started from nothing, have left their families many, many times voluntarily. They were thrown out and have managed to make a life for themselves, liberate themselves with their own heroism. And that doesn't get recognized often enough. So, you know, she's here because she's the one who ran away from home. She's the one who did this and that. I don't want to get the plot away. But at the end of the day, Katrina is like so many trans women, trans youth I know, heroic. But it's not only that that makes her a hero. She is, it's not just she can do this, she can do that. What I also wanted to show is the heroism of accepting help. Mm-hmm. She has family, and how that relationship and those relationships grow are also heroic. Part of being a hero is also being able to say, I can't do this alone. Will you please help me? And to have a family or a village around them say, yes, I can. I really feel in my work that I want to get away from this idea that there's this single hero who has to go slay the dragon. And in order to do that, he has to be on this quest and leave and deny his love for his mother and his family and his wife, or, you know, at the time, and go off. And I'm using this pronoun, this gendered pronoun, very intentionally, you know, and he does this and he does that. And, you know, he comes home after 20 years and nobody knows who he is anymore. That to me is not the only way to be a hero. I think many heroes can be raised by the villages that they live in. They can bring the villages with them. In fact, I think that villages themselves can be heroic in how they work with each other. And that's what I wanted to put in this book.
A theme you tend to throughout the novel is about our relationship with time, with beginnings and endings, not the least of which is the looming end plague, which I think readers will naturally relate to the pandemic, but which you beautifully complicate through music. At one point you write, for music to happen, every note must sing, then end. As both a writer and composer, what do you think music has to teach us as we face our own kind of end plague?
I'm going to switch instruments just for a second from the violin to the piano. With the piano, the moment you hit the note, the moment you strike the key, the note is dying. There's no way to sustain the note. I mean, you can use the sustain pedal, but you can't sing the note. The note, the moment you're hitting it, that note, that's the loudest that note is ever going to be. And from then, it's just all, in fact, it's called decay, right? Sound decays. And when you think about it that way, it's such a sad scenario. It's so sad, right? You boom, and there's never any growth. You're dead. You know, boom, that's it. You're gone. But also in piano, you have this thing called legato. Where you connect one note to the next, and what you end up doing is you give the illusion that the piano is singing, you give the illusion that there's an ongoing motif, an ongoing melody. And I think in some ways our lives are like that. From the moment people say, from the moment we're born, we're going to grow, of course, but we are on our way to our demise. And if we think about our lives in isolation, that's kind of sad. But if we see ourselves connecting to our ancestors and to our children, rather that, you know, if they're children of biology or children of legacy, they're still our children, then we can comfort ourselves with the knowledge that there's the singing melody of which we're a part. I think we're really, really lucky. Unlike the piano note, we can hear our ancestors resounding in us. and we can feel the song of the people whose lives we've touched swell and grow. So that gives us, I think, a bit of an advantage over the notes on the piano. We can remember, and we can look at the people that we've touched, and through them we can dream and we can hope.
Rika, is there anything else that you want to say to listeners?
Thank you, and thank you not just for my work, but supporting the work of writers. I really appreciate people who, in their lives, take the time out to read. It's still quite humbling to me. For those of you who choose to read my words, that you've taken that much time out of your life, and I'm just really humbled by all of that. And I guess the other thing that I want to say about my book and queer books in general, even if you don't identify as trans, or even if you don't identify as queer, I hope that when you read my book, or you read this book, Read Life Among Common Stars, it's not just the sadness, and it's not just the ordeals that you see, but I hope that you see some of the humor. There's some funny bits here. Mm-hmm. And I think that we're not family until we learn to laugh with each other. And there are some jokes, and there's some goofiness, so don't worry if you're reading something and it sounds horrible on one level, but it's funny on the other, because life is that way.
I was reading this scene where Katrina and Shizuka go to the department store and they're looking for something for her to wear for her performance. And I just was just weeping. I felt so seen in that whole section. And I'm not trans. The way you tend to her emotional world, and the way that she's able to reach out to others and they're able to see her, like, I was just so moved by it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
And that is an experience that is a very trans experience, but also another experience that's very human. And how do we get through some of these things? We go to the food court and get something we can laugh about. And, you know, I hope that, you know, this book in some ways gives you something like that as well.
I certainly believe that it does. Light from Uncommon Stars is available from Tor Books September 28th. You can find a link to Rika's website and her book on the Old Mole webpage. Thank you so much for joining me today, Rika.
You're so welcome, Chelsea, and thank you, everybody. It was a lot of fun being here.
To the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Joe Clement. That was a little bit more banjo playing by myself. And before that, Chelsea Ratzliff was talking with author and poet Rika Aoki about her forthcoming book, Light from Uncommon Stars. Well, to round out today's show, I'm going to finish my conversation I started last week on our Labor Day episode with Marianne Garneau. Marianne is an organizer with the Industrial Workers of the World. She is the chair of the IWW's Education Department. She teaches labor studies in a New York university, and she also publishes the online journal Organizing.Work, which is a kind of primer of organizing experiences, lessons, and perspectives from workers. Last week, our conversation was about a lot of history and social ideas. This week, we want to talk a bit more about nuts and bolts organizing concerns and relate them to building the power we need to change the world. So let's talk about worker power. We're talking about legalistic versus material understandings of power.
This is where the whole like PRO Act thing comes in. What a lot of like reformers in the labor movement want to do is make it legally easier to obtain recognition. But that's just formality.
Right. And there's this feeling that the state is the most powerful entity in the room, which is kind of ironic considering all of this radical posturing assumes and is frenetic to convince everybody else that we really have the power. But when it comes down to like actually trying to implement on that understanding, there's fear and doubt, and there's this sense that, well, we have to get the objective conditions right for that.
Look at the way business views the state or acts in relation to the state or in relation to law. Do they genuinely seem afraid of breaking the law? Take ULPs as an example, unfair labor practices. It's basically the legal remedy available to workers when they are organizing if the boss breaks the law. Employers don't give a flying whatever about unfair labor practices. They specifically violate the law all the time and do so intentionally because they know that the penalties are not that severe, and they also don't really care. They're not fighting fair, they're fighting to win, you know? So, yeah, the idea that the state is some neutral arbiter, which is the fiction that we have in our labor relations system, is a fiction. And yet, people think that what we need to do, as you're saying, is tinker with the laws, tilt them a bit more in workers' favor, and then we'll be able to unleash a more powerful working class. That's not really the way that things work.
Yeah, in my own experience, in my own union, we are told that there are three types of power. There's legal power, there's relationship power in the sense of the relationship with the boss, and then there's worker power. And it's absolutely mind-boggling how they will lay out that sensible, useful three-part analysis of power and say that, you know, our power isn't in the law, it's not in our relationship with the boss, it's with the worker. But then here we are talking about how to get the best contract, how to appeal to the boss's sense of reasonability and asking for things they'll say yes to. And there's this just kind of disconnect around what we know.
Like, how do they describe relationship power?
I mean, just in the sense of being in the good graces of the boss, giving the boss what they want or compromising, doing things that maintain the relationship of the boss who is assumed to have the power, then dispensing that in the ways that we want.
Yeah. So behind that is some notion that if we maintain good relations, then we can get things from the employer, basically.
Right.
Yeah. Which is hilarious. I mean, any worker knows that that's not the case, right? It's not that your boss is always has their hair on fire and is always trying to punish you or something, but this fiction that you are somehow equals having some kind of rational exchange or debate is a fiction. If you want something that the employer doesn't want to give you, they just don't give it to you. They don't even give you a reason. It's not that good relationship is not actually leverage. It's also a fiction, right?
If we look at the situation of how the earth is heading for climate chaos, and the bosses knew about this for a long time, bosses will make decisions that are rationally against their interest if, in some sense, at least that they perceive, it means that they have power and control. We can't even talk about meeting them as rational equals because they rationalize according to their own power, not according to some objective shared interest.
I've always felt this was summarized really well by that comic. It looks like it was a New Yorker comic where there's people sitting around a campfire after the apocalypse, and there's a guy in like a tattered business suit, and he's saying, sure, we destroyed the world, but for a minute there, we delivered really great value for our shareholders. Like, that's basically the logic by which business decisions are made.
It's not just business. It happens in the public sector too, especially after 40 years of neoliberalism, government and public service administrators trying to get things done cheaper, but which, you know, may actually mean worse service for the public, to say nothing of what the workers experience when they're sped up or understaffed. It's very tempting to want to engage our bosses like they're going to listen to us and understand, because our whole culture, American culture, is rooted in this idea of class collaboration or classlessness, and that we are all somehow equal, at least in the sense that we equally want things to work out for whomever it is we're theoretically serving. But the reality is the bosses, whether they're private sector or public sector, make these decisions that from the perspective of the rest of society, or the workers at least, are totally irrational.
I think one thing the pandemic has done is really accentuated or put into relief what is considered to have value. the services that are provided, people's well-being and happiness, don't actually have that much value in a capitalist society, right? We've seen how little value is actually placed on human life during the pandemic. We don't want services to completely break down, but we can stomach millions of deaths. And this gets back to the politics thing, where how is it then that we imagine that there's some kind of exchange of ideas taking place in the political sphere, where if we get the right people elected who have the right ideas, or if we form the political party that has the right inspiration, that somehow we are going to, I don't know, get out of this mess. I mean, clearly what is taking place instead is a pretty naked power struggle. And on the one side, you have working people who value their own lives and value many other things like dignity, quality of life. On the other hand, you have a massive countervailing force that is basically trying to wring as much profit out of society as possible. The only way to really counter that is by developing the power of working people, the latent power we have, in that all of society depends on us. And that's the other thing that was really put into relief during the pandemic, with the notion of, for example, essential workers, the fact that society does not actually function or happen unless we have things like grocery store clerks. We don't particularly need, I don't know, investment bankers, but we need grocery store clerks when you strip right down to it, what we need in order to function. And yet, you know, it's like people get called heroes and at the same time get the same amount of kind of disrespect and discipline from their employer, even as we're realizing how essential they are, which is why it's never enough to rely on objective conditions to kind of win this battle for us. We really do need to organize to be able to deploy our power.
And just to kind of bring it back to the organizing perspective, when we're talking about organizing our power, it's very specific to what we are doing. Because when you're talking about labor power, we are talking about the specificity of what we do and interrupting or controlling that. And I'm wanting to ask you to speak more to how important it is for workers to really understand what they're doing, what their work is, how it mechanically flows, in order to then make decisions about how best to take control of that in a way that causes the employer to do what we want.
I do think that one of the most important sources of leverage in workplace struggles comes from the regular flow of work. Actual work stoppages are obviously also extremely important because, generally speaking, work stoppages interrupt business, they interrupt the flow of profits, they interrupt what that entity is trying to do. But also taking a look at workflow and work processes can be a tremendous source of leverage in the workplace. I mean, this is not a new idea either. Slowdowns, work to rule, that kind of thing have been around as tactics for a very long time. Any way of sort of sabotaging the work process, that's been around for a long time. But I think that that's another kind of neglected source of worker power in most of the labor movement.
People want big picture advice, and really what you have to say and what I think we all need to spend more time thinking about is the nuts and bolts. There's a fear that without a big picture perspective that we don't actually really know where we're going. And I think that there's a kind of faith involved in this, both involved in labor organizing and involved in trying to build a better world, where we don't get to start from the end point. We only get to start from where we are. And that process is uneven and is open to mistakes. And at the same time, there's really no way of moving forward except from starting where we are. I'm wondering if you can speak how workers need to start thinking differently about where we fit into the picture of our power in society, because we can talk about how the law doesn't work for us. And there are people out there who will say, well, if we all just stick our hands in our pockets and walk out, we don't have to deal with any of this. But there's a lot of room in between, which is where I think things actually are going to happen. They're going to happen because workers take the initiative in their own workplace to just solve their own problems. And they're not trying to solve the problems of the world. But out of that process, they become connected to what are social problems.
It's basically an issue of learning to develop your own political agency, right? Some people think that political agency is something you exercise at the ballot box. You and I see political agency somewhat differently. We think it has to do with being able to wield the leverage that we have. And if all of society tomorrow put their hands in their pockets and insisted on a more humane social and economic configuration, then we would have that. The question is, how do we get there? Well, you have to get people, not one individual at a time, but one sort of constituency at a time to be able to put their hands in their pockets. A very important constituency is workplaces. That's an area where you have an employer exercising power over a defined boundary of people. You need to get those people to be able to exercise their collective political agency by, you know, putting their hands in their pockets. How do you get people to be able to put their hands in their pockets? They have to develop relationships of trust with one another. That's why people strike. They don't strike because they are suddenly inspired by the notion of revolution or the notion of workers' rights or the idea of a raise. They strike because their coworkers strike. And in order to do that, you need to have workers talking to each other about what the problems are and what it is that they want to accomplish. And everything really kind of pushes against that. I mean, if you organize, you notice that the hardest thing to do is actually to get workers to talk to one another. I have a friend who's been organizing various groups of workers as they reach out for help. And he said to me that his back of the napkin rough calculation is that if a group of workers actually gets to a point of forming what we call a committee, so just a sort of group of them talking and taking action, if they actually get to the point of forming a committee and taking action, they win like 80% of the time. The barrier is in actually getting to that point. I mean, I publish a website that is primarily dedicated to the nuts and bolts of organizing because I don't believe in licking your finger and sticking it in the air and seeing which way the wind is blowing and making big predictions and prognostications about what's going to happen or whether we are on an upswing of class power or so on and so forth. I believe in really kind of patiently explaining to people how to get from A to B and then from B to C, and demystifying that a bit and giving a little bit of instruction on that, because it is possible. And the barriers that we have to overcome sometimes are not what we think, right? The barriers we have to overcome is not electing the right blessed politicians. The barriers we have to overcome are us learning to view our grievances at work as significant and as changeable, and developing the act of solidarity with our coworkers to do something about that.
That reminds me about all summer, in addition to this contested narrative of a labor shortage, which is qualified in terms of there's no labor shortage, there's a wage shortage. There's been this trend of workers quitting their jobs en masse, often closing restaurants and other businesses. Well, these mass quittings are exciting, and there's a number of people who seem to view them like propaganda of the deed, these actions that show workers everywhere what we can do if we withhold our labor. But you take a different interpretation of these actions. What's going on here, and how can we relate what's going on there to the task of labor organizing?
Yeah, someone once pointed out to me that their workers do take direct action all the time, the most common form being just quitting. And that's true. The problem is that it doesn't really put you in a position of power. And so there was an example in New York recently where there is a small butcher chain where a huge number of workers quit simultaneously. And the dispute originally started with the employer taking down BLM and pride signs and flags from the business, just the kind of capricious random crap that employers do. No reason to take these things down, not harming the business, but again, they're in charge, so they can do stuff like that single-handedly. And they immediately face repercussions. And apparently a lot of their workforce is African-American, queer, you know, drawn from those communities and populations, presumably because they were paying lower than the prevailing wage for butchers for, you know, this skilled trade, basically. And so the employer screwed up, and the workforce's response was to quit en masse. And look, you can say that it was kind of a noble thing to do and a gutsy thing to do, and it was. However, the day after, you don't have any leverage anymore, right? If you don't work there anymore, then you don't have any leverage anymore, and those workers will all scatter and find different jobs and with an entirely different set of coworkers and be in basically the same position with respect to a new boss. And instead, what I wish we had was more of a practice and more of an education of how to take collective action without removing your own leverage, but in a sustained way within a workplace so that you can start to shift the power balance between yourself and your employer.
If you have the willingness to quit or to otherwise face the consequence of being fired, it seems like you might as well spend that on taking a risk trying to change things rather than just, you know, saying, I'm going to leave these problems and then they won't be problems anymore for me.
Like sometimes you'll get an organizing lead and a worker will be like, everybody's really fed up and I'm fed up and we're all at the point of quitting. We don't even care anymore. We'll do anything. And it's actually very difficult to get people who are in that position to take action, even though they seem to be willing to go all in and risk it all. I guess that shows yet again the ways in which we are conditioned in society to not take collective action, to not take action against our employers in a way that empowers ourselves, to not basically build capacity with our own coworkers that we can use as leverage. We're generally speaking conditioned not to do that.
It's a part and parcel, I think, of the individualism of American culture, where we think about how we're going to solve this for ourselves. And usually the most straightforward way to solve problems for ourselves is just extricate ourselves from them, because we are taught you can go get another job. We need to be able to think in terms of we have a problem and we need to do something about it. And that means sticking with it and grappling with whatever it's going to take to actually change that problem. And that's a really big problem in our culture, because it's not just that we don't have union education. It's that I think on a much deeper level, our understanding of agency and how we cause things to happen in society and in our lives is myopic and is trapped in this lens of the individual.
Well, and also we don't see working conditions as political. We don't see them as changeable. We don't see them as a result of the disproportionate power the boss has over us. We don't see them as things that could be otherwise. The one thing that we are kind of allowed to see as changeable is maybe wages and benefits. But we don't look much beyond that, even within the labor movement, at the deep working conditions, the pace of work, the control over work. You know, those things are eminently political, I think.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was Marianne Garneau talking with me about labor organizing and thinking about how to build power on the job and what gets in the way of that. We'll post a link to the first part of our conversation from last week when the show is posted. You can go to organizing.work to learn more about how to organize your workplace. That's it for the Old Mole Variety Hour today. Thanks to our guests. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Jenny Brown for talking about the history of abortion and reproductive rights struggles and the present day realities and possible futures. Thanks to Chelsea Ratzliff for having Rika Aoki on to talk about her forthcoming book with Tor Books, Light from Uncommon Stars. Thanks to Denise Morris and Patricia Kohlberg for being huge supports for the Old Mole over this last year. Don't forget our Betty Lee photo retrospective on the KABU website. You can find that, the show, and past episodes at kboo.fm/oldmole. Tune in next week for more news, reviews, and interviews from our radical perspective. I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour and KABU Radio. And don't forget to tune in on Wednesday, the 15th, to hear a special Old Mole episode that's going to be part of our kickoff of the fall membership drive, Sounds of Democracy. And we're going to have a special Old Mole episode from 10 to 11. Jan Hawken is going to be talking with Don Sampson, Peo Peo Mox Mox Chief of Walla Walla Peoples and former chairman and executive director of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. They're going to be talking about Native storytelling and responding to climate crisis and educating on climate issues. Norm Diamond will bring us another episode of Another World is Possible, where he is going to reflect on life, language, and organizing among Native American people. And Patricia Kohlberg is going to be interviewing Bette Lee about her photography, which we have been promoting. You need KABU, and KABU needs your support. You can do that at kboo.fm/give.